This is a reading of An Outline of Esoteric Science. It is the fourth part of Chapter 5. I am beginning on page 349 with paragraph 47. Imaginative cognition is achieved when the lotus flowers develop out of the astral body. Through the exercises we undertake in order to reach inspiration and intuition, specific movements, configurations, and currents that were not there before appear in our ether body or life body. These are the organs that allow us to acquire the ability to read the hidden script and what lies beyond it. The changes in the ether body of a person who has achieved inspiration and intuition present themselves to supersensible cognition as follows. A new center in the ether body, located approximately in the area of the physical heart, becomes conscious and develops into an etheric organ. A great variety of movements and currents run from it to the various parts of the human body. The most important of these currents go to the lotus flowers, permeating them and their individual petals, and then pour out like rays into external space. The more highly developed the person in question, the larger the surrounding area where these currents are perceptible. In a genuine training, however, the center in the area of the heart does not develop immediately. First, the way is prepared for it. A temporary center appears in the head, which then slips down to the vicinity of the larynx, and then moves into the area of the physical heart. In an abnormal development, the organ in question might form immediately in the vicinity of the heart. In this case, instead of achieving supersensible perception calmly and objectively, the person in question would be in danger of becoming a visionary and a fanatic. As students of the spirit develop further, they learn how to take the currents and differentiations that have developed in the ether body, make them independent of the physical body, and use them independently. In this process, the lotus flowers are used as tools for moving the ether body. Before this can happen, however, certain currents and rays must have formed all around the ether body, closing it off as if in a delicate network and making it a self-contained entity. Once this has happened, nothing hinders the movements and currents taking place in the ether body from coming into contact with the external world of soul and spirit, so that outer soul spiritual events and inner ones taking place in the human ether body intermingle. At this point, such a person consciously perceives the world of inspiration. Cognition of this sort does not appear in the same way as the cognition that applies to the physical world of the senses. In the sensory world, we receive perceptions through our senses and then form mental images and concepts about them. This is not the case when we know about something through inspiration. What we know there is immediately present in a single action. There is no such thing as thinking about a perception after it occurs. In inspiration, what we acquire in the form of a concept after the fact in sensory physical cognition is presented simultaneously with the perception. This is why we should flow into and merge with the surrounding world of soul and spirit and be unable to distinguish ourselves from it if we had not developed the network in the ether body that has just been described. When we do the exercises that lead to intuition, they do not only affect the ether body, but also work into the supersensible forces of the physical body. We must not imagine, however, that the effects within the physical body are accessible to our ordinary sense perception. They can only be assessed by means of supersensible cognition and have nothing to do with external cognition. They are a result of consciousness maturing to the point where it is able to have intuitive experiences even after having excluded all previous outer and inner experiences. Intuitive experiences, however, are tender, subtle, and delicate. At its present stage of evolution, the physical human body is coarse in comparison to them and presents a major obstacle to the success of intuition exercises. But if these exercises are carried out with energy, persistence, and the necessary inner tranquility, they eventually overcome the mighty obstacles presented by the physical body. Students of the spirit notice that this has happened when they gain control over certain expressions of the physical body that formerly occurred completely unconsciously. They may notice it also because they feel the need to regulate their breathing, for example, for short periods of time, so that it harmonizes with what their souls are doing in these exercises or other meditations. In inner development, the ideal is not to perform any exercises, including breathing exercises of this sort, by means of the physical body itself. Instead, everything that needs to happen with regard to the physical body should come about only as a consequence of pure intuition exercises. At a certain level in their ascent along the path to worlds of higher cognition, students of the spirit notice that the forces of their personalities are being held together differently than they are in the physical world of the senses. In the physical world, the I makes the soul forces of thinking, feeling, and willing work together in a unified way. Under the ordinary circumstances of our lives, these three soul forces always relate to each other in specific ways. For example, we see something in the outer world and our souls like it or dislike it. That is, the mental image of the thing is necessarily followed by a feeling of liking or disliking. We may desire the thing in question or have an impulse to change it in one way or another. This means that our will and our ability to desire something are associated with an idea and a feeling. This happens because the I unites visualizing, thinking, feeling, and willing, thus bringing order into the forces of the personality. This healthy order would be disrupted if the I were to prove powerless in this respect, if our desires wanted to take a different direction from our feeling or thinking, for example. Thinking that a certain thing is right while wanting to do something that we do not think is right, or wanting what we dislike instead of what we like, would not indicate a healthy state of mind. On the path toward higher cognition, however, we actually notice that thinking, feeling, and willing separate and acquire a certain independence from each other. For example, that certain thoughts no longer seem to automatically impel us toward a specific way of feeling and willing. At this point, although in thinking we can perceive something correctly, we again require an independent impulse coming from ourselves in order to come to any feeling or willed decision about it. During supersensible observation, thinking, feeling, and willing do not remain three forces radiating from their common center in the eye of the person in question. They become independent beings, three separate personalities, so to speak. The individual I must become that much stronger, because rather than simply having to impose order on three forces, it must now guide and direct three beings. This separation, however, should persist only as long as supersensible observation continues. Here again it becomes apparent how important it is for exercises leading to higher training to be accompanied by ones that provide stability and firmness for our capacity for judgment and our life of feeling and will. If we do not bring these qualities with us into the higher world, we will soon see that the I proves too weak to act as an appropriate guide for thinking, feeling, and willing. In this case, the soul is torn apart in different directions by three personalities, so to speak, and its inner unity comes to an end. But if a student's development proceeds in the right way, the transformation of these forces signifies true progress, and the I retains its mastery over the independent beings that now make up the soul. In the further course of personal development, this evolution continues. Thinking, having become independent, stimulates the appearance of a fourth specific soul spiritual being that can be described as a direct influx of thought-like currents into the human being. The entire cosmos then appears as a thought structure that confronts us just as the world of plants or animals confronts us in the physical domain of the senses. Similarly, our newly independent feeling and willing stimulate two forces in the soul that also act like independent beings within it. Still a seventh force and being appears, which is similar to our own I. This whole experience is linked to another one. Before entering the supersensible world, we know our thinking, feeling, and willing only as inner soul experiences. As soon as we enter this world, we perceive things that express the element of soul and spirit rather than the physical sensory element. There are now beings of soul and spirit standing behind the perceived qualities of this new world and presenting themselves to us as an outer world, in the same way that stones, plants, and animals present themselves to our senses in the physical domain. Students of the spirit can perceive a significant difference between the world that is now disclosing itself to them and the one they are accustomed to perceiving with their senses. A plant in the world of the senses remains the same, regardless of what the human soul feels or thinks about it. Initially, this is not the case with the images of the world of soul and spirit. They change according to what we feel or think. We imprint a certain character on them in accordance with our own essence. Let's imagine that a certain image appears in the imaginative world in front of us. It shows itself in one form if our souls remain indifferent to it. But as soon as we experience liking or disliking with regard to this image, it changes its form. To begin with, therefore, these images not only express something independent of and external to us, but also reflect what we are. They are thoroughly permeated with our own human essence, which is drawn over the beings in question like a veil. Even when we are confronted by a real being, we see something of our own creation instead of the being itself. We can actually have something totally true in front of us and still see something false. And this is not only the case with regard to the aspects of our essential nature that we actually notice in ourselves, but everything else in us also influences this world in the same way. For example, we may have hidden tendencies that do not become evident in our life because of our education and character, but they do influence the world of spirit and soul, which assumes a particular coloration as a result of the total being of each one of us, regardless of how much we ourselves know or do not know about this essential being. To advance beyond this level of development, we must learn to distinguish between ourselves and the spiritual outer world. We must learn to exclude all the effects of the individual self on the world of soul and spirit around us. The only way we can do this is by knowing about what we ourselves bring into this new world. The important thing, therefore, is that we must first have a true and thorough knowledge of ourselves, so that we can perceive the surrounding world of soul and spirit in a pure way. It is inherent in certain facts of human inner development that knowing ourselves in this way takes place quite naturally and as a matter of necessity when we enter the higher world. As we know, we each develop our I, our self-awareness, in the ordinary physical world of the senses. This I now acts as a center of attraction for everything that belongs to the human individual. All our inclinations, sympathies, antipathies, passions, opinions, and so on, gather around this I, as it were, which is also the point of attraction for everything we call an individual's karma. If we were to see this I exposed, we would recognize its need to encounter specific forms of destiny in this and subsequent incarnations, according to how it lived in earlier incarnations and what it acquired there. With all of this clinging to it, the I is necessarily the first image that appears to the human soul ascending into the world of soul and spirit. According to a law of the spiritual world, this double of ours must be the very first impression we receive there. This underlying law becomes easily understandable if we consider the following. In our physical sensory life, we perceive ourselves only to the extent that we have inner experiences of ourselves in our thinking, feeling, and willing. However, these perceptions are inner ones that do not present themselves to us in the same way that stones, plants, and animals present themselves. In addition, We also become only partially familiar with ourselves through inner perception, because something within us prevents deeper self-knowledge. What prevents this is an impulse to immediately transform any character trait if self-knowledge forces us to acknowledge it and we do not want to succumb to self-deception. If we do not give in to this impulse, if we simply divert our attention from this aspect of ourselves and remain the way we are, we deprive ourselves of the possibility of getting to know ourselves on this particular point. But if we delve into ourselves and hold up certain character traits for inspection without deceiving ourselves, either we will be in a position to correct them, or we will be unable to do so in our present situation. In this latter instance, a feeling that we must describe as shame creeps into our souls. This is how healthy human nature actually works. It experiences many different types of shame in the process of self-knowledge. Now, this feeling already has a very specific effect, even in our ordinary life. People with sound thinking will make sure that the aspects of themselves that give them this feeling have no outer effects, that they are not played out in outer actions. Shame, therefore, is a force that impels us to conceal something within us and not allow it to become outwardly perceptible. If we give this due consideration, we will understand why spiritual research ascribes much more wide-ranging effects to an inner soul experience that is very closely related to the feeling of shame. This research reveals a type of hidden shame in the hidden depths of the soul, a shame that we do not become conscious of in our physical, sensory life. However, this hidden feeling works in a way that is similar to how the ordinary feeling of shame works in everyday life. It prevents a person's innermost being from appearing to that person as a perceptible image. If this feeling were not there, we would confront a perception of what we are in truth. We would not only have inner experiences of our ideas, feelings, and will, we would also perceive them just as we perceive stones, animals, and plants. This feeling conceals us from ourselves, and at the same time it conceals the entire world of soul and spirit, because the fact that our own inner being is concealed from us means that we are also unable to perceive the means of developing tools for recognizing the world of soul and spirit. We are unable to transform our own being to receive the organs of spiritual perception. However, if we work toward acquiring these organs through genuine training, the first impression that appears to us is an impression of what we ourselves are. We each perceive our own double. This self-perception cannot be separated from perceiving the rest of the world of soul and spirit. In ordinary life, in the physical sensory world, the effect of the feeling described above is that it constantly closes the door of the soul spiritual world in our faces. If we want to take even a single step toward entering this world, this subconscious feeling of shame immediately appears and conceals the part of the world of soul and spirit that wants to become evident. The exercises that were described earlier, however, open this world to us. And in fact, this concealed feeling acts like a great benefactor of human beings, because any powers of judgment, feeling, life, or character we acquire without spiritual scientific training do not make us capable of standing up to the perception of our own nature in its true form without further preparation. Perceiving this would deprive us of all of our self-esteem, self-confidence, and self-awareness. We need to take precautionary measures in cultivating our sound judgment, feeling life, and character, in addition to doing the exercises for higher knowledge in order to ensure that this does not happen. Through proper training, we learn as if unintentionally enough spiritual science and the necessary means of self-knowledge and self-observation to have sufficient strength to encounter our double. For students of the spirit, it is then like seeing what they have already learned in the physical world in another form, as a picture of the imaginative world. If we have already acquired a rational grasp of the law of karma in the physical world, we will not be unduly shaken by seeing the seeds of our destiny imprinted on the image of our double. If we have used our powers of judgment to become familiar with the evolution of the cosmos and of humankind, and if we know that at a certain point in this evolution the forces of Lucifer invaded the human soul, it will not be difficult for us to bear it when we become aware that Luciferic beings and all their influences are contained in this image of our own essential nature. We see from this how necessary it is that we not demand to enter the spiritual world ourselves before we have understood certain truths about this world through the ordinary powers of judgment that we develop in the physical world of the senses. Before wanting to actually enter the supersensible worlds, students of the spirit should make their own the information in this book that precedes the discussion of knowing higher worlds. In the course of a legitimate self-development process, they should do this on the basis of their ordinary powers of judgment. In a training that does not pay attention to safeguarding and solidifying the power of judgment, their life of feeling and their character, it could happen that the higher world would approach the students before they had the necessary inner faculties. If this happened, encountering their doubles would depress them and lead them into errors. If, however, human beings avoided this encounter entirely and were nevertheless led into the supersensible world, which would also be possible, they would be equally incapable of recognizing this world in its true form. It would be totally impossible for them to distinguish between what they themselves were projecting onto things and what these things really were. It is only possible to make this distinction if we perceive our own essence as an image in itself. If we do so, everything flowing from our own inner nature detaches itself from what surrounds it. In our life in the physical world of the senses, the double immediately makes itself invisible by means of the sense of shame described above when we approach the world of soul and spirit. Simultaneously, however, the double also conceals this entire world. It stands like a guardian in front of that world, refusing entry to anyone not yet suitable for entering. The double can, therefore, be called, quote, the guardian of the threshold to the world of soul and spirit, unquote. We encounter this guardian of the threshold not only when we enter the supersensible world in the way described, but also when we enter it through physical death. The guardian reveals itself gradually in the course of our soul's spiritual development between death and a new birth. In this case, however, we are not oppressed by this encounter because we know about worlds we did not know about during life between birth and death. If we were to enter the world of soul and spirit without encountering the guardian of the threshold, we would succumb to one deception after another, because we would never be able to distinguish between what we ourselves were bringing into this world and what really belongs to it. Genuine training, however, is only permitted to lead students of the spirit into the domain of truth and not into the domain of illusion. It is inherent in this training that the encounter with the guardian must take place at some point, since it is an indispensable precautionary measure against the deception and illusory fantasy that are possible when we are observing supersensible worlds. One of the most indispensable precautions all students of the spirit must take as individuals is to work carefully on themselves to avoid becoming delusional visionaries who may succumb to deception and autosuggestion. Whenever instructions for spiritual training are followed correctly, the potential sources of deception are destroyed. Of course, this is not the place to go into all the numerous details that have to be considered with regard to these precautions. Only the most important points can be indicated here. The deceptions that come into consideration here come from two sources. Some of them come from the fact that we color reality with our own soul nature. In ordinary life in the physical world of the senses, this source of deception poses relatively little danger, because there the outer world always forces itself upon our observations in its actual form, regardless of how we might attempt to color it with our desires and interests. But as soon as we enter the imaginative world, the images we perceive change because of these desires and interests of ours, and we confront a seeming reality that we have shaped ourselves, or have at least contributed to shaping. Through encountering the guardian of the threshold, students of the spirit become familiar with everything that is within them that they might carry into the world of soul and spirit. This eliminates the first source of deception. The preparation that students undergo before entering the world of soul and spirit accustoms them to disregarding themselves, even when observing the physical world of the senses, allowing only the essence of things and events to speak to them. If we have prepared thoroughly enough, we can wait calmly to encounter the guardian of the threshold. This encounter will be the ultimate test of whether we are really also in a position to exclude our own being when we face the world of soul and spirit. In addition to this, still another source of deceptions appears when we misinterpret an impression we receive. A simple example of this type of deception in our physical sensory life is what happens when we sit in a train and think that the trees are moving in the opposite direction, while we ourselves are actually moving with the train. Although in many cases such deceptions in the physical world of the senses are more difficult to correct than this simple one, it is easy to see that in this world we find the means to do away with such deceptions if our sound judgment takes everything into account that can contribute to an appropriate explanation. The situation is different, of course, as soon as we make our way into supersensible domains. In the world of the senses, facts do not change when human beings are deceived, so it is possible for unbiased observation to use the facts to correct the deception. In the supersensible world, however, the matter is not that simple. If we apply false judgments in approaching a supersensible process we are trying to observe, we insert these false judgments into the process itself, where they become so entangled with actual fact that it is not immediately possible to distinguish them from the fact. In this case, the error is not inside us, and the correct fact outside. Our error has become a component of the external fact, and can therefore not be corrected simply by observing the fact in an unbiased way. With this, we have pointed to a superabundant source of possible deceptions and illusory fantasies for those who approach the supersensible world without the right preparation. Just as students of the spirit acquire the ability to exclude deceptions that come about because of how their own nature colors supersensible phenomena, they must also acquire the gift of inactivating this second source of deception. They become able to exclude what comes from themselves once they have recognized the image of their own double, and they will be able to exclude this second source of deception once they have acquired the ability to recognize from the makeup of a supersensible fact whether it is the truth or a deception. If deceptions looked exactly the same as facts, it would be impossible to distinguish between them, but this is not the case. In the supersensible worlds, deceptions have inherent qualities that distinguish them from realities. It is essential for students of the spirit to know which qualities distinguish the realities. It seems self-evident that someone unacquainted with spiritual training might ask, "How is there any possibility of protecting ourselves against deception, since there are so many sources of it? And are students of the spirit ever certain that all their so-called higher knowledge is not based only on deception and auto-suggestion?" Anyone who talks like this is not taking into account the fact that the very way a true spiritual training takes place blocks deceptions at the source. In the first place, through their preparation, true students of the spirit will have acquired enough knowledge about the causes of deception and auto-suggestion to be able to protect themselves. In this respect, they have more opportunities than any others to become sufficiently matter-of-fact and competent to judge what they encounter in life. Everything they experience makes them distrust indefinite premonitions and questionable flashes of so-called inspiration. Their training makes them as careful as possible. In addition, any true training first guides its students to thoughts about great cosmic events, that is, to things that force them to exert their powers of judgment, refining and sharpening them in the process. The only way we could miss out on this sharpening of our healthy powers of judgment, which give us certainty in distinguishing between deception and reality, would be by refusing to enter such distant realms and insisting on restricting ourselves to quote-unquote revelations closer at hand. However, all of this is not the most important thing. What is most important is inherent in the very exercises that are used in genuine spiritual training. They have to be arranged in such a way that the student's consciousness has a complete and exact overview of what is going on in the soul during meditation. First of all, a symbol is developed to bring about imagination. There are still images taken from outer perceptions in this symbol. We are not solely responsible for its content. And since we do not create it ourselves, it is possible for us to delude ourselves about how it comes about. We may misinterpret its origin. However, students of the Spirit remove this content from their consciousness when they move up to the exercises for inspiration, where they contemplate only their own soul's activity that shaped the symbol. Here, too, error is possible. We have acquired the character of our soul activity through our upbringing, education, and so on. We cannot know everything about the origin of this activity. However, students of the Spirit also remove this activity of theirs from their consciousness. So if something still remains, there is no remnant of anything that cannot be surveyed. Anything that can possibly mingle with this can be assessed with regard to its entire content. In their intuition, students of the Spirit thus possess something that shows them the makeup of anything that is a totally clear reality in the world of soul and spirit. If they then apply the signs they have recognized as being characteristic of soul spiritual reality to everything that presents itself to their observation, they will be able to distinguish semblances from realities. And they can be certain that applying this law will protect them from deception in the supersensible world, just as certainly as they will not mistake an imagined piece of hot iron for a real one that actually burns them in the physical world of the senses. It goes without saying that we will only apply these criteria to knowledge we regard as our own experience in the supersensible worlds, and not to what we receive as communications from others, and understand with our physical intellect and our healthy feeling for the truth. Spiritual science will attempt to draw a precise boundary between what they have acquired in these two different ways. They will willingly receive information about the higher worlds and attempt to understand it with their powers of judgment, but when they categorize something as personal experience or direct observation, they will have tested whether it presents the very same characteristics that infallible intuition has taught them to perceive. Once students of the Spirit have the encounter with the guardian of the threshold behind them, they face further experiences as they ascend into supersensible worlds. First of all, they notice a certain inner relationship between this guardian and the seventh soul force that was described above as forming itself into an independent entity. In a certain respect, this seventh being is none other than the double, the actual guardian of the threshold. It poses a specific task to students of the Spirit. They must use their newborn selves to guide what they are in their ordinary selves, which appear to them in images. This results in a sort of struggle against the double, who will constantly try to gain the upper hand. Achieving the right relationship with the double, not allowing it to do anything that does not happen under the influences of the newborn I, strengthens and consolidates the forces of the human being. In the higher world, self-knowledge is different in some respects than it is in the physical world of the senses, where self-knowledge appears only as an inner experience. In contrast, the newborn self immediately presents itself as an external soul phenomenon. We each see our own newborn self as a separate being in front of us, but we are not able to perceive it fully. Regardless of what level we have reached on the path to supersensible worlds, there are always still higher levels where we will perceive ever more of the higher self, which can therefore reveal itself only partially at any given level. However, when we first become aware of some aspect of the higher self, we are overcome by an extremely great temptation to look at it from the standpoint we acquired in the physical world of the senses, so to speak. This temptation is actually a good thing, and it must happen if our inner development is to proceed properly. We must each observe our double, the guardian of the threshold, and place it in front of the higher self in order to notice the discrepancy between what we are and what we are meant to become. When we do this, however, the guardian of the threshold begins to assume a completely different form. It presents itself as an image of all the obstacles confronting the development of the higher self. We perceive what a burden we are each dragging around with us in the form of the ordinary self. If our preparations have not made us strong enough to say, quote, I am not going to stop here, I will strive unceasingly to develop toward my higher self, unquote, we will falter and shrink back from what is ahead of us. In this case, we have plunged into the world of soul and spirit, but quit working our way forward. We become prisoners of the form that now stands before our souls as the guardian of the threshold. The significant thing about this experience is that we don't have the feeling of being prisoners. We are much more likely to believe that we are experiencing something completely different. The figure summoned up by the guardian of the threshold can create the impression in our souls that the images appearing to us at this stage of our development already encompass all possible worlds, that we have arrived at the pinnacle of knowledge and no longer need to exert ourselves. Instead of feeling like prisoners, it's possible for us to feel that we possess all the immeasurably rich secrets of the cosmos. We will not be surprised by this experience, which is the exact opposite of the true state of affairs, if we consider that we are already in the world of soul and spirit when we have this experience, and that one of the world's idiosyncrasies is that experiences can appear in reverse. This fact was already pointed out earlier in this book when life after death was described. The figure that we perceive at this stage of our development shows us something different from what first appeared to us as the guardian of the threshold. In the double, as we first perceived it, we saw all the character traits that the ordinary self possesses as a result of the influence of luciferic forces. However, in the course of human evolution, another power has also been able to move into the human soul because of Lucifer's influence. This is what was described as the power of Ahriman in earlier chapters of this book. It is the power that prevents us from perceiving the soul spiritual beings of the outer world lying behind the surface of sense-perceptible things. What the human soul has become under the influence of this power is shown in image form in the figure that appears during the experience that has just been described. If we approach this experience with the right preparation, we will interpret it correctly, and then another figure will soon appear. In contrast to the lesser guardian described earlier, we can call this figure the greater guardian of the threshold. The greater guardian tells us that we must not remain at this stage, but must continue to work energetically. The greater guardian awakens in us the awareness that the world we have conquered will only become a truth and not metamorphose into illusion if we continue to work in the appropriate way. However, if we approach this experience without having been prepared for it by a proper spiritual training, when we encounter the great guardian, something that can only be compared to a feeling of immeasurable horror or boundless fear will fill our souls. Just as the encounter with the lesser guardian makes it possible for us to test whether we are protected against the deceptions that can arise when we insert our own being into the supersensible world, the experiences that ultimately lead us to the greater guardian allow us to test whether we are capable of overcoming the deceptions that can be traced back to the second source described above. If we are able to resist the immense illusion that leads us to believe that the world of images we have reached is a rich possession, while in reality we are mere prisoners, we will also be protected against mistaking semblance for reality in the further course of our development. To a certain extent, the guardian of the threshold will assume an individually different form for each human being. The encounter with the guardian corresponds to the experience that overcomes the personal character of our supersensible observations, and makes it possible for us to enter an area of experience that is free of personal coloring and valid for every human being. Students of the Spirit who have had the experiences described above are then able to distinguish what they themselves are from what is outside of them in their soul's spiritual surroundings. They will then realize that we need to understand the cosmic process described in this book in order to understand human beings themselves and their lives. We understand the physical body only if we recognize how it has been built up through Saturn's Sun, Moon, and Earth phases of evolution. We understand the ether body only if we trace its development through the Sun, Moon, and Earth phases, and so on. However, we also understand what is presently involved in the Earth's evolution if we recognize how all this has unfolded gradually. Spiritual training puts us in a position to recognize that everything in the human being is related to corresponding facts and beings in the world outside of us. It is a fact that every part and organ of the human being is related to all the rest of the world. In this book, it has only been possible to present a sketchy outline of the facts. However, we must keep in mind that the physical human body, for example, was present only in seminal form during the Saturn phase of evolution. Later, during the Sun, Moon, and Earth phases, its organs, hearts, lungs, brain, evolved from this seminal endowment. Thus our heart, lungs, and so on are related to the Sun, Moon, and Earth phases of evolution. Something similar is true of the organs of the ether body, sentient soul, and so on. Human beings took shape out of the entire world, immediately surrounding them, and every detail of our human makeup corresponds to a process or being in the outer world. At the appropriate level of inner development, students of the Spirit begin to recognize this relationship between their own individual beings and the greater world. This level of cognition can be described as becoming aware of the correspondence between the microcosm or smaller world, that is the human being, and the macrocosm or greater world. Having broken through to this stage of knowledge, students of the Spirit can then begin to have a new experience. In spite of being aware of themselves and their full independence, they begin to feel as if they have grown together with the entire structure of the cosmos. They have a feeling of merging with the entire cosmos and becoming one with it, yet without losing their essential nature. We can describe this level of development as, quote, becoming one with the macrocosm, unquote. It is important not to think of this as a cessation of an individual consciousness, as if the essence of a human individual were flowing out into the universe. To think of it in this way would only reflect the opinion of an untrained faculty of judgment. In the sense of the initiation process described here, the individual stages of higher cognition can be listed as follows. Number 1. Studying spiritual science by initially making use of the power of judgment which we have acquired in the physical world of the senses. 2. Acquiring imaginative cognition. 3. Reading the hidden script. This corresponds to inspiration. 4. Living one's life into the spiritual surroundings. This corresponds to intuition. 5. Recognizing the relationship between the microcosm and the macrocosm. 6. Becoming one with the macrocosm. 7. Experiencing all of these previous experiences as a totality, as a fundamental mood of soul. We do not necessarily need to think of these stages as happening one after the other. On the contrary, depending on the individual student, training may proceed so that one level has been only partially completed before the student begins with exercises that correspond to the next level. For example, it may be very good for a certain student to do exercises leading to personal experiences in inspiration, intuition, or recognizing the connection between microcosm and macrocosm, even though he or she has only acquired a few imaginations with any degree of certainty. Once students of the Spirit have experienced intuition, in addition to being able to recognize the images of the world of soul and spirit and read their interrelationships in the hidden script, they will also acquire direct knowledge of the actual beings who work together to bring about the world to which we human beings belong. Through this, they also get to know themselves in the forms they possess as spiritual beings in the world of soul and spirit. They have worked hard to be able to perceive the higher I, and have realized how they need to continue working in order to control the double, the guardian of the threshold. But they have also encountered the greater guardian, who constantly urges them on to greater effort. This greater guardian becomes the example they want to emulate. And once this has happened, it becomes possible for them to recognize who it is standing in front of them in the form of the greater guardian. In the student's perception, the greater guardian is now transformed into the figure of the Christ. The essence of this being and his intervention in Earth's evolution has been made clear in earlier chapters of this book. In this way, students of the Spirit are initiated into that same exalted mystery that is linked with the name of Christ. The Christ discloses himself to them as the great example for human beings on earth. To those who have recognized the Christ in the spiritual world as a result of their initiation, historical events on earth in the fourth post-Atlantean evolutionary period, the Greco-Latin Age, also become comprehensible. For students of the Spirit, the intervention of the exalted Son Being, the Christ Being, in Earth's evolution at that time, and his ongoing work within this evolution, become a matter of direct experience and personal knowledge. Through intuition, therefore, the purpose and significance of Earth's evolution are revealed to students of the Spirit. The path that is described here as leading to knowledge of the supersensible worlds is one that every human being can follow, regardless of his or her present situation in life. In talking about such a path, we must keep in mind that although the goal of knowledge and truth is the same in all ages of Earth's evolution, the starting points have been different at different times. People wanting to set out on the path to the spiritual world at present cannot start from the same point as ancient Egyptian candidates for initiation, for example. That's why present-day individuals cannot simply take up the exercises assigned to students of the Spirit in ancient Egypt. Since that time, human souls have progressed through various incarnations, and this process is not without meaning and significance. The abilities and characteristics of human souls change from incarnation to incarnation. Even if we observe human history only superficially, we can see that all of life's circumstances were different after the 12th or 13th century than they were before. Opinions, feelings, and even human abilities changed. The path to higher cognition that is described here is one that is suitable for souls incarnating in the immediate present. It takes its point of departure for spiritual development from where people stand at present, whatever the circumstances of their individual lives may be. Just as the forms of outer life change, evolution from one period to the next leads humankind to ever different forms with regard to the paths to higher cognition. At any given time, outer life and initiation must be in perfect harmony. The end of chapter 5 of An Outline of Esoteric Science.